You're listening to the Brave Parent Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Susan Maples. I'm here for all parents who deeply love their children and want their health span to equal their lifespan. In other words, to be healthy their entire lives. If that's you, tune in. In every episode, we're grappling with contemporary issues that affect every child every day in areas that your doctors either don't know or don't have time to tell you. It's your time to be brave. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to season two podcasting for a Brave Parent. We're very excited today. My partner, Lauren, and I are very excited to have an incredible guest on our show who's a rock star in my profession and a very good friend of mine for the last 20 years, and Kevin Boyd. Some of you might even know Dr. Kevin Boyd, because if you've read the most recent New York Times bestseller, James Nestor's book, Breath, he talks a lot about Kevin Boyd in that book. And so that's been, must have been interesting for you, Kevin, to be part of that. But I also know in our profession, he is a passionate driver of the shift from ignoring pediatric airway issues and sleep-related breathing disorders until they escalate. We've been good at saying, well, they'll outgrow this, they'll outgrow that, we'll just wait and watch. And Kevin has been one to bring, he's a pediatric dentist by training, who has an expansive knowledge in pediatric airway and practices pediatric orthodontics and orthopedic movement to help kids prevent the terrorizing plague that has swept over my generation, 26% obstructive sleep apnea, putting them at risk for everything you don't want in life, from obesity to brain fog and dementia and heart attack and stroke. And it really begins in infancy, in the womb. And when we look at what we can do to prevent that in children, the sky's the limit. We just need to corral our professions to help recognize it. And you, brave parents, to ask better questions of your dentists and physicians and orthodontists to get some help for your kids. I also want to acknowledge, before we let Kevin roll, because he will roll and it'll be fun, it'll be a great conversation, that during the writing of Brave Parent, the book section or chapter called A Collection of Evidence-Based Pieces called Breathe, which is Growing the Tongue Box. It's the shape of things to come. So with that, Kevin, my dear one, Kevin Boyd, the expert of all things airway.
As long as they're young.
Right?
I call a seven-year-old a geriatric patient. You've heard that. We like to recognize the subtle antecedents really early. That's my platform. So what can I say to begin is that it's difficult if you are bringing your child to a dentist. We like to see kids by age one. That's the Academy of Pediatric Dentistry. Infant oral health is a big program we've had for decades. And what I like to call primary care dentists, who are general dentists who have expertise and competence in seeing kids. There's so many children in our country and so many kids with oral health needs. And oral health used to cavities and gum disease, right? And maybe trauma. And what about airway? That's not an oral health problem. That's the domain of the ENT and the respiratory people. And it's like, if it's above the clavicles, it's a shared domain with dentistry. And that's what the American Dental Association now is endorsing. Dr. Steve Carlson.
I'm really hoping that we're going to shift that from under one, which we're still having a hard time getting dentists to, participate in that, to under 1 week. I mean, I would love it in under 1 month at least, so we can look at.
I like to look at 20-week ultrasounds.
I get it.
Well, it's not. oh, what can you do with a kid before they're born? Well, you know, besides mom, pregnancy yoga and vitamins and things, yeah, that's all good. But how about mom's sleep? Mm-hmm. Who's paying attention to mom's sleep during gestation?
I saw a little boy yesterday with such incredible oral habit problems already at 1 week old that we're having a hard time with everything, you know, breathe, suck, swallow at the same time. So, and then we see kids that aren't able to even move from sucking on a bottle to real foods. They can't eat and they're gagging. And, you know, why is that? And, you know, we don't recognize that severe gaggers are airway issues, right? So tell us about some of the telltale signs we see even in kids under 1 year.
Well, even what you bring up is I think really important, Susan. And people may say, well, you're not a speech and swallowing expert. You're not a speech and language pathologist. And it's like, you know, I don't have to be an ENT to recognize enlarged tonsils. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to treat them directly. I'm going to refer them for evaluation. And you are a huge collaborator, Susan, and you probably learned so much from speech and swallowing experts. And you know how it relates. It's above the clavicles. I mean, this is something that's very important. Clavicles, you know, collarbones, is that we get criticized. Oh, you know, why don't you just stick to doing cavities? And it's like, well, A, we don't have a ton of cavities in my practice because we enforce, like you do, Susan, healthy eating. And we help parents enforce that in their own kids. So I'm really interested in helping parents understand is that the role of the dentist, you know, someday cavities are going to go away. Did you hear me? I mean, someday cavities are going away.
Not anytime soon, unfortunately.
Well, what the World Health Organization has a big movement called Ending Childhood Dental Caries. Wow. They also have Ending Childhood Obesity. These things
they
are.
They also recommend we shift that we consume less than, you know, 5% of our calories in sugar. That's not happening.
Well, who thought would happen with smoking that has happened? I mean, my wife is from Ireland and we spend a lot of time in Ireland. Who would think that the pubs in Ireland, you can't smoke in? I mean, you couldn't even see when you'd walk into a pub before. And on airplanes, and, you know, but most of this generation, they can't even believe that that used to go on. So I'm really optimistic that tooth decay is going to go away. And what are dentists going to do? And there's a lot of dentists who maybe, wow, well, what will I do? You know, you won't go out of business. You can focus on doing other things like what we're doing. I still fix cavities, just not that many of them. So that is a real, I mean, I live in Chicago. There's lots of potholes. And do the pothole fixers who make a living fixing potholes, do they want somebody to come up with a street surface that will resist potholes? What are they going to do for a living? Well, they'll find something else to do. I mean, this is, you know, so silly. So
Kevin, you've done a lot of work with anthropology, looking back on human populations, even as recently as a couple hundred years ago, without the thwarted development of the face that we see now. We see smaller faces, smaller tongue box, where the airway, the tongue, is literally crowding the tube we breathe through. So the open tube right now, if you're watching this podcast or listening as you drive or wherever, your lips should be lightly together in a resting position, your teeth just barely apart, and your tongue completely suctioned up to the roof of your mouth while you're breathing easily through your nose down the back of your throat. That's a good open airway. If the tongue rests low and back, you're having trouble breathing through that nose, you're going to have to open your mouth, pop your mouth open to take a breath through your mouth. That mouth breathing begins a cascade of problems in babies that cause the collapse of the midface. The tongue is super important. So how is it that we have in a couple hundred years change the entire facial structure when our genetic code has not changed in 200 years?
Well, yeah, our genetic code, our genome is 300,000 years old. But,
right.
You know, there's been minor microevolutionary change, like being able to digest milk after the age of four. You know, lactose intolerance used to be the wild state, the natural form, because nobody drank milk after 4 years old until fairly
how is
recently.
It that we how is it that we changed the face shape so much that we got these smaller, longer faces with more and more airway problems? I mean, airway problems are huge. 24% of adults suffer from obstructive sleep apnea, and only 4% are diagnosed. You know, that you look at the heart attack rate, you know it's part of that.
Well, our genome was not, you know, some assembly required. I guess you see that on some things you buy. Well, you know, Mother Nature gives us a genome, and guess what? The environment, we need to enlist the environment to build it, to help express it. Some subtle and, you know, beginnings or antecedents or risk factors that would make it so that they couldn't breathe through their nose. Guess what? They died. They did not survive childhood. And that's why you don't see crowded jaws, narrow jaws, backward jaws. You don't see them in the human skeletal record until about 300 or 400 years ago. That's 300,000 years. You don't see it. Well, okay, so a three-year-old died. Yes, with perfect teeth. Kids didn't live long enough to develop malocclusion. That's why we never see any of it. Even you know, kids who didn't survive childhood. If you see a 30-year-old that died 5,000 years ago with perfect jaws and teeth, guess what? You know exactly what his jaw looked like when he was 6 weeks old. It had to be perfect, or you didn't make it. So that's a real broad brush stroke there. But it really is with the nursing and weaning, baby-led weaning, breathing clean air, learning to click. Like if a kid couldn't do that, they wouldn't learn language. That was the first language. It was click speaking. There's Aboriginal people in Africa that still use the click speaking. That's also for parents. That's a test you can do at home. If your kid has what we call mild dysfunction, see if your kid can click. If they can't, you know what?
Another word for muscle dysfunction.
Yeah, that's right.
That 16 muscles that make up the tongue have to coordinate to stick in there to make a click.
That's a great tip for parents. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's something simple they can do at home.
Well, the other thing is habitual mouth breathing or audible breathing or snoring. These are all three big telltale signs that there's a problem. If there is something in the throat that is vibrating during breathing, either a tongue or enlarged tonsils or adenoids, that's a restriction to a good solid breath of air through your nose. Why do we see tonsils enlarge more in some kids than others, Kevin?
Well, and again, the ENTs are in a little bit of a quandary about that, but you know, they're big. Let's get them out of there. Like or oral surgery. Why do wisdom teeth get impacted? Well, they're causing a problem. Let's get them out of there. And you know, you and I and the Endeavor, rest of the Endeavor group, we're very curious about this and we want to know the cause. Well, adenoids, the first question I ask when I see a new patient is, did your kid have eczema? Was there a history of eczema? Eczema is mediated by immunoglobulin, their immune function cells, IgE specifically, and that has major respiratory implications. Kids who have eczema are at risk to be on something called the atopic march. Is that eczema falls into, they call it dermatitis, atopic dermatitis. Well, that can lead to asthma. That can lead to gradual nasal disuse, as you know, Dr. Guimeneau used to call it, mouth breathing. And that's what enlarges the tongue.
Goes generally from eczema to what we call chronic rhinitis, which is the major runny or stuffy nose.
So, and food allergies.
And food allergies for sure, which are really on the rise. So what we think about when we think about tonsil enlargement, because the nose has all this great magic, right? We use our nose to warm the outside air that goes in to our bodies. and to purify the air, filter it from particles, and also to release gases, nitric oxide, that help, again, purify the air, and then humidify the air. If we miss all the magic of the nose and we just breathe the air in, this is a backup valve, the mouth. If we take all the outside air in through our mouth, we don't have a lot of help there. We're basically breathing in air that's not ready to be consumed. The tonsils and adenoids are thought to enlarge because they're doing a lot of that filtration for us. So we tend to see mouth breathers get enlarged tonsils. Now, if you can imagine, if you're a mouth breather and your tonsils get large, what does that do to your breathing tube? Crowds them further. So now we have bigger obstructions back there, making it harder to breathe through our nose. And then what Kevin's talking about, nasal disuse, if you're breathing through your mouth, it's sort of like use it or lose it. If you don't use your nose gets extra goopy. It gets enlarged caverns. The little spaces get smaller. The nose becomes less useful. And now you have to breathe through your mouth. So this is a very tricky downward slope. When we see mouth breathing, it's indicative that we're in some trouble. And when Kevin talks about that atopic march, what are you going to do when you have a chronic runny nose? You're going to breathe through your mouth. I ask parents all the time, do they breathe through their mouth? Only when they're sick. How often are they sick? It turns out a lot. So Kevin, tell us more about allergies and immunology or atopic march or tonsils or anything.
Well, it's always thought that, boy, the adenoid, and an adenoid is a tonsil. It's a throat tonsil, and not everybody has adenoid. And like adenoid is it's a name they give when there's lymph tissue in the back of your throat, behind, you know, the roof of your mouth, and if it swells, it changes its name to an adenoid. It's what we call a pathological moniker. Well, you know. That can, if your roof of your mouth is pushed back, if your upper jaw is not forward enough, even if you're not in an underbite, that can get very close to that adenoid, which is, you know, at the gate from the nose where the air is, you know, coming in. And that can cause a problem. Well, adenoid always gets the blame for what we call pharyngeal obstruction. And it's not, and Dr. Guimeneau, who's the first person in 1976 who identified sleep apnea can be in kids, not just adults, his theory was, you know what? It's not the adenoids that start all this. It's the gradual nasal disuse that the kids start mouth breathing for whatever reason, and the airborne pathogens are coming in, and the body needs to fight it by creating an immune response, and the adenoids is the first thing to swell. So it really, you know, at least some of the cases that start that way, the adenoid isn't just there. It has to be stimulated. And then the throat tonsils get bigger. So those are the other things that can crowd the pharynx or the airway is overweight. You know, so there's three things, the tonsils and adenoids, the position of the jaws, are they forward or are they back? If they're back, they push the base of the tongue into the back of the airway. They push the soft palate closer to the adenoids. But if a kid is overweight, even just a little, okay, that fat will not just accumulate in their belly and their arms, but it accumulates in the throat, in the soft palate, and the tongue. And that enlarges all those structures. And that can really make it difficult for a child to breathe through the nose, and they will start breathing through the mouth.
And you often wonder what comes first, the chicken or the egg with the tonsils and adenoids, because for years now we have said, well, if there's an obstructed airway, we need the tonsils and adenoids out. That's the number one defense. And it's accepted that that's the number one defense. When I was a kid, they took tonsils and adenoids out like crazy for infection. Now you have to kind of prove that you have infection over and over. We're getting better with our ENTs recognizing that this is an airway obstruction, they need to come out. But if, as Kevin is saying, if the root cause of the adenoid and tonsil enlargement has nothing to do with the tonsils and adenoids has to do with a breathing pattern, and we don't fix the root cause. Yeah, you can take these lymph structures out that are overgrown, and all of a sudden the breathing tubes open a little further, but it does nothing to prevent long-term problems from the lack of the facial development thwarted by these musculature problems, the problems, the root cause. So Kevin and I, along with a group of people internationally, there's a group of, I don't know how many of us, 16 or so leaders throughout the world that come together on Monday nights for a couple of years now, called Endeavor, to really help spread this news to our professions to be able to recognize these kids earlier and treat the root cause. We're not ENTs, we're not doing tonsil and adenoid surgery. Yes, we can refer to that, no problem, but that is only the beginning. We want to fix the facial development problem. So I want to shift a little bit and talk about the role of the orthodontist. Now, when you hear orthodontist, you hear dentist, which stands for teeth, movement of teeth. Orthodontists do a lot more than move teeth. Unfortunately, they're not accustomed to treating little kids where Kevin and I are most concerned. They usually start at age 6 after the permanent teeth start to come in. And we're working on that shift as well. But the orthodontist does something else that we can do as pediatric orthodontists in our office. And again, I see people of all ages. So I am officially considered, I guess, a general dentist. I consider myself a total health dentist, but Kevin has an even better word for it, which is
primary care dentist.
A primary care dentist. Kevin's a pediatric dentist. We both practice orthodontics, or what I would call orthopedics, in the practice. So talk about facial growth and development, what we can do when we see low lazy tongues and the collapse of the upper arch and mouth breathing and the cascade of the atopic march, sleeping problems, restless sleep, eating problems where they're messy eaters. I mean, what do we do? What do we do in our offices that help this?
Well, as I alluded to earlier, is that the genes just don't produce. They don't predestine somebody. Genes have to be told what to do by the environment. There are a few things that, no, they're going to do what they're going to do. If your kid has a recessive B gene for eye color from mom and dad, your kid's going to have blue eyes no matter what the environment is dictating. And there's very few diseases that are determined, you know, other than genetic syndromes, but things like Huntington's disease and sickle cell disease, those, you got those genes, you're going to get the disease, okay? But hardly anything works that way. The genes need to be told what to do. They unfold based upon the environment and they express themselves that way. So the jaw, you know, when it comes out, if a kid is chewing, if a kid is nose breathing, if a kid is breathing clean air, they're going to have the best chance to have the ideal optimal structure that the parents, that the mom and dad gave them the genetic potential for. But it doesn't just automatically happen. Like I tell parents, after age 3 or 4, your kid's going to get taller, even if you're not promoting a healthy lifestyle. They may not be as tall as they could be, but they're going to be pretty close to it. Long bones, legs and arms and all that, they just sort of, you don't have to do much and they will express themselves. But jaws, especially at the teeth, like at the teeth tips, the jaw bones will get bigger from age 4 down here at the bones, but not at the teeth. So you can see that the front teeth, there's no space and they're scrunched together. Guess what? You don't do anything like myofunctional therapy or expansion or chewing hard food. You know, move to Africa and live with hunter-gatherers, and then that will help grow the jaw. Who can do that? Those teeth will be about the same width. That's the transverse dimension, we call it, when they're 12, okay? It is. And if all you're worried about is cosmetics,
So what age said 4 years old? I was always taught by 6 years old, you have first full transverse. You're saying by 4 years old, you have. Oh,
maybe sooner, but yeah, maybe EA sooner. Bogue, yeah, Dr. Bogue, MD, DDS, late 1800s, early 1900s, looked at thousands of kids, and he limited his dental practice, even though he was a physician, to helping children before the age of 5 or 6 gain what he said respiratory advantage by spreading the baby teeth, not to make the teeth straight or anything like that, but to help them breathe and be resistant to having relapse after they got their adenoids out. You know, adenoids and tonsils coming out, that's a temporary fix, but it won't necessarily, and that's been known for 100 years, it won't completely resolve all issues.
But, so when Kevin says myofunctional therapy, he's talking about therapy for physical therapy for the muscles of your mouth to do the expansion on its own. In dental school, we learned this adage from Ramford and Ash, my predecessors, and then Pete Dawson. Muscles always win. We will, for instance, if you hunch over and you walk like this, your bones will literally bend over time and you will change the structure of your back. We know this. So we try to like have our kids stand up straight. The muscles of the tongue and the face, if you put your tongue up right now, close your mouth and really force your tongue up to be as broad as you can, and it's pressing on your teeth, you can literally, if you were able to do that as a child, spread the little suture line in the palate. Interestingly, that when you're born, your brain is only 20%, 20 to 30% of its adult size, but by 2 years old, it's 80%. So all those little puzzle pieces that form the skull are growing to accommodate a brain that's growing. If your muscles of your tongue are able to push that jaw forward and outward, and we're able to strengthen all the muscles of our tongue through chewing real food and swallowing, we can have a palate that mimics that broad, flat tongue that we have. So we can teach kids how to grow a jaw that doesn't need braces, where there's enough room. And by the way, we get a broader base of the nose to breathe better. That's myofunctional therapy in a bit of a nutshell.
Yeah, I think the adage that you alluded to is whenever there's a conflict between muscle and bone, bone will always yield. It just will. And, you know, every parent knows the baby, when they're born, they have soft spots, and those are sutures. And as the brain grows, those sutures spread apart and bone forms over them. Well, it's the same thing here. You have a palatal facial sutural complex. They're fontanelles, they're soft spots, but they're in here. Now, even after the brain's fully formed and the head circumference is what it's going to be by 10 or 11 years old for the rest of their life, maybe even sooner. If every time, hypothetically, I'm making this up as we go, if every time you had a thought, your brain would expand a little bit, those sutures would never close. They would always be a little bit patent, you know, that you would be able to influence them. But, you know, the brain's its full size. We don't need that. But every time you talk, chew, and breathe, you're stimulating the palate in the facial sutures. They're a little soft spots. So those sutures can stay patent. We're seeing this in Mariana Evans, who's an orthodontist in Philadelphia that I work with on research in a anthropology museum. We're seeing young adults with sutures, the incisive suture between your eye teeth, you know, your big canines, your fangs and front teeth, is that suture is patent in young adults in prehistoric times. That means they were chewing all the time. We used to spend half our waking existence chewing, right? There was not processed food, just biologically processed food. And that's why nature did it that way. Okay, some assembly required. I'm going to give you these jaws in this face, but you got to work. And that's all people did if they were going to survive. So I don't know. That's a broad brush too, but it's true.
I think the idea of being able to, you know, we can mechanically widen an upper jaw and the lower jaw will follow. It's like the lower jaw sits in a box commanded by the box top. When you have a box you're putting together and you have a lid on it, if you had a bigger box top, you know, you might not get that lower box to grow, but in the mouth, it can. When it has room, it can grow. So the idea is we focus a little more on the upper jaw than the lower, both in a transverse or widthwise and also forwardwise. We want it to be out there so the nose, so everything is healthier. And the idea that we can do that through chewing real food and breathing and swallowing correctly is impressive, right? We've grown up on sucking right now, especially kids are, they go right from the bottle to sucking pouches of yogurt and applesauce and pureed foods out of jars and bags. And we're really, really big proponents on helping kids learn to chew. But let's talk about early treatment. As soon as we can, when we see the collapse of that midface in like a 3-year-old, we're often able to get an appliance in the mouth that literally can broaden that suture that Kevin's talking about to build a wider, bigger craniofacial respiratory complex. I wrote about the craniofacial respiratory complex. That's Kevin Boyd's words. He's the one who coined that phrase. But in the development of that, we're able to get in there a lot younger than 6 years old when the orthodontists typically start. Do you want to, and that's your practice, Kevin, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I'm pretty much, seven, eight, that's geriatrics to me now. And I want to get kids at least assessed. I want their risk assessed. And I want parents to understand is that if your child's jaw is not wide enough for their age, and there's algorithms that determine that. You know, a 4-year-old, 24 plus 4, it seems really simple. It's an index. It's not diagnostic, but it points in a direction. We want them forward enough. You know, we don't want them to be chinless. Like me, I had teeth pulled. I didn't get treated till I was 13. And I have no chin. I have sleep and breathing problems, and I'm not overweight. So it's the structure. So you want not just the lower jaw forward, but the upper jaw forward. And you want the height to be ideal, optimal. And there's a way to do that. When your child bites down after the age of 3, you should be able to see about 90% of their lower teeth. All right. That's sort of what we're looking for. And these are things that you can do at home and just look. So we want to optimize in 3 dimensions. Width, which is the least complex to do it age appropriately. And that's what I do with, if a kid's got 20 teeth by 2.5 or 3 years old, and the parents, they're both on board, but if there's a dissenting parent, I won't do it because it confuses the child. Should I be doing this or not? Daddy thinks so, mommy doesn't. Usually it's the other way around. The height, you must control the height. If it's a deep overbite, you do things by widening the jaw. You can help open up that deep overbite when they bite down, you don't see any of the baby teeth in the front, on the lower front. And then the front to back. Well, we're not going to optimize that at 3 or 4 or 5, but we're going to set it up just by widening. So if we can engage more primary care, general dentists, pediatric dentists, or orthodontists who aren't comfortable treating really young because they don't get training in that. They don't learn how to manage expectations of children and parents in their residencies. Ask me how I know, but that I'm a pediatric dentist. I had hundreds of hours of training in managing anxiety in children. So if you just get the kid wide enough, if that's all you want to do, you're going to be helping that kid. As long as the parents know there's more work to be done down the road. But to say, well, if I can't do it all now, you shouldn't do anything. I mean, that would be like, you know, so ridiculous.
Supporting that width development, Kevin's office and ours too, Kevin's been doing it for a lot longer than we has a myofunctional therapy component where kids now learn how to use their tongue in their new tongue box. So building a bigger space for the tongue, and knowing, because we have these habitual patterns, muscle memory of how the tongue behaves. So he does this in conjunction with myofunctional therapy. Now, keep in mind, he's not moving teeth. He's orthopedically expanding the space where the tongue sits and then teaching the tongue how to live there better.
Perfect. That is perfectly said. That's what we do. We build a house for the tongue to live in for the rest of its life. Mother Nature used to do that from in utero throughout life. The tongue had one job starting at about, 12 weeks of age in utero, is to build itself a nest to live in for the rest of its life. And that building process starts in utero when a baby is chewing and swallowing amniotic fluid. And then when they're born, neonates, nursing and weaning, if a woman is able to and wants to nurse, we should all encourage that, because nothing builds the box, as Susan
calls
it.
For how long?
As long as they want. And as long as it's comfortable for both mom and child. Nobody has any business telling a mother how long she should breastfeed her child. I'm sorry.
I also believe, like, for working moms who are not able to do that during the day and they're pumping and storing breast milk and feeding them breast milk through a bottle, the minute they walk at home at night, to me, reverence for the mama. Like, you know, other people in the household need to be focused on getting dinner on the table and the rest of the household things. The minute you walk in, you should be able to have a breastfeeding experience so that we're getting more time. It's not just about giving the baby the really good juice, right? The good stuff, the breast milk. It's about the act of sucking. I don't really know how suck got such a bad reputation to begin with. I don't know why we say it sucks when we're talking about something bad. A good suck is a really good thing.
Yeah. No, we should. Hey, that's a really interesting analogy. No, I think, you know, in human milk for human babies, cow's milk for baby cows. I mean, oligosaccharides, oligosaccharides. Human milk has over 100 of them, maybe moving into 200 of them, and they stimulate the immune system. Cow's milk has 2 to 4 of them, and, you know, who knows what they don't do. So getting, even if you can't, you know, on the breastfeed, please give your baby human milk. And if you can't produce milk, there's milk banks. It's expensive. That's got to go down. But instead of using an artificial nipple, once in a while, you know, you have to do that on the road, try cup feeding. Just Google cup feeding.
Let's talk about cup feeding. We even use for neonates who struggle, who can't suck. They're premature enough that they're not able to have a good suck swallow. Cause you have to literally be able to breathe, suck, and swallow all at the same time. It's very complex. So talk about cup feeding a little bit, because this is something I don't hear any of the pediatricians talking about.
No, and they don't. And it's like baby-led weaning as well. It's a component of baby-led, you know, nursing and weaning. But you can use a shot glass. You can use, even there's some neonatal intensive care units, kids who are failing to thrive. And you know what? They can be cup fed. They don't need a bottle. It can be done. But that's an extreme, you know, situation. Is that if you get the baby used to, you know, lapping it up, they'll do it. They'll drink it.
Let's say that for whatever reason you have chosen or cannot breastfeed your baby, and there are some really good reasons that people are not able to do that. What kind of nipple for a bottle would you recommend? I mean, what we really want to do is mimic the difficulty it takes to suck from a breast. And by the way, as a kid grows older, they get better at sucking. We don't increase the aperture of the woman's breast, right? So tell us a little bit about what you recommend for instead of breastfeeding if someone's really not able to do it.
Yeah, I think the my feeling on this, Susan, is, you know, there's orthodontic nipples. I'm not buying it. Anything that comes between the baby's tongue and palate besides a mom's nipple is going to be inferior. Artificial nipples, but you know what? You got to deliver that nutrition. I understand that. So there might be varying degrees of, badness associated with artificial nipples. I just don't. The trick is to just minimize how much you have to introduce an artificial nipple.
For sure. And if you have to, that we use slow flow nipples, things that they have to work a little harder at.
Medela, I think from Australia, Donna Geddes, she's the person that's the most authority on that. Geddes. And she does speak for Medela. And apparently there is a nipple, that I'm hearing about that is least offensive.
I like that. I also want to make a big shout out that we're not big proponents of pacifiers. Again, 200 years ago, these little pieces of rubber that kids put in their mouth to often distort the palate. Like if you think about putting a little rubber ball on the top of your palate and pushing your tongue up on it, you now have a low tongue and something else shaping the palate that doesn't belong there. And then the guard on the pacifier with every suck pushes back, thwarting the interior growth of the upper and lower jaws. So you can imagine every suck puts pressure on the front of the mouth. So we're not big proponents on pacifiers, even though, again, I think they're often pushed with pediatricians. So as Bill Hanks said, get earplugs, not pacifiers. But I want to shift the conversation before we run out of time to treatment strategies. Lauren, share your story about like realizing that your child had an airway problem and the community you were living in and trying to figure out, where do I go? Who knows this stuff? How do I find someone? It's not easy.
No, it's not easy at all. And we had recently relocated from Central Illinois to Nashville. So it was a brand new area. And I thought with a bigger city, there would be a lot more options there. But it hasn't been. It's been so tough. And, you know, we did find one, even when I had, like, we did our first examination and then, of course, talked to you about it afterwards. I mean, it's a very expensive investment, of course. And, it was a very interesting process even because I'm learning there are variations in what, you guys deliver, even if someone says that they have some sort of focus on airway health, but it's hard when you then recognize it in your kids. Like my kids were always restless sleepers. I thought that was normal. The mouth breathing, the snoring from one, you're always told, oh, that's cute. Or, this is just part of being a baby. And then when you have the awareness, it's like suddenly you want to fix it, but it's finding the right people to fix it. That is so important. You're
struggling with this too. Yeah. And I think, again, one of the reasons for a podcast like this is to get you to ask better questions of your docs. And when I say that, this is what Dr. Oz did, whether you like Oz or not. He got people to ask better questions. When we create a deficit among our healthcare professionals, ask questions they don't know about, they're more likely to dig in than if I tell them from the front of the room or Kevin tells them from the front of the room, you really need to be doing this. Like, yeah, I might get around to it. But if my patients are demanding it, now I'm really needing to do it. Mm-hmm. Kevin, what are your thoughts on how we increase treatment strategies, increase awareness, education, and offer more treatment strategies? And Kevin, Lauren mentioned money. She's not poor, but oh my gosh, it was a big price tag for a family, two working parents, and a big price tag. And now, I mean, that brought tears. Like I'm going to tell you,
two children.
Yeah.
So you're leading into something that, I do research with Darius Logmany. He's a pediatrician, pediatric sleep doctor at one of the largest tertiary care children's hospitals in Chicago. And we see so many kids who there's financial obstacles to care. I mean, there's lots of obstacles to care. One is, well, I didn't get braces till I was 13. So, and you're not really an orthodontist. So that's an obstacle to care. But financial is the biggest. What I said earlier, this is really important. There's a paper, a scientific paper that came out in from Seattle that they said there's a lot of children who don't have Medicaid. They don't have access to care. Mm-hmm. And they have what's called medically debilitating jaws that aren't right. It's called an index of orthodontic treatment need. And if you do early treatment on them, they go from having medically necessary to elective. Mm-hmm. I just discovered this paper. So I told you about three dimensions, all right? Height is so complex, you must control it. Is early in life, when you see a kid's jaw growing long or short, you know, and this isn't as bad as this, like if a kid has a long face or an adenoid face, they call it, from mouth breathing, it must be controlled and identified and controlled. And that's a teaching technique that I can, you know, do. But the other one is front to back, right? Retrusive chin or underbite, maxillary, Jay Leno, right? Those need to be controlled and guided toward optimal structure. But the width, the transverse, there is no excuse whatsoever to not first identify that as a risk. And the kid does not have to have an underbite in the back. It's called a crossbite. That is McNamara, the most brilliant academic orthodontist in the world, where you trained at Michigan. He said, you don't need a crossbite to identify transverse deficiency. And he didn't say it then, but he does now. That means there's not room for the tongue. And that has airway implications. So every kid should be expanded. It's not that expensive.
So how do we get the question, and you've done a great job of skirting it because you don't know the answer and neither do I, but how do we get more practitioners to be able to recognize and treat it throughout our, what's your recommendation for someone like, we get these all the time, Kevin, you and I, you see the same emails I do. I've got a friend who's got a patient in this state, and does anyone know an airway person near, you know, Keokuk, Iowa? It's like, well, oh my gosh, what are we going to do about this? So what's your recommendation for parents who are listening to this right now, who don't know where to start? They don't really want to get on an airplane and fly to Chicago to see you or to Michigan to see me. Where do they start?
Well, online, I guess, because they don't have to get on a plane. Maybe with our Endeavor group, we need to have a network that people can at least reach us. And I, if you give me permission, Mom, I can call your primary care dentist and explain to them what it is and how to measure. This wasn't taught to me in dental school any more than it was to you, Susan. We haven't always been like this. And we haven't always been like this.
No. So you're so generous, you know, by the way, with the dentist. Kevin allows dentists to come into his office to observe and to learn. And he's just so generous. He's been such a great teacher, but this is a real deficit for all of us on Endeavor. And we're now moving more toward, we're seeing a lot of like telemedicine for myofunctional therapy, so we can at least access the myofunctional therapy face-to-face with children from your living room, which is great. We cannot do that with dentistry. You have to bring your teeth to us, your mouth to us to help you. So we want to stimulate more thought processes among your, and don't think, by the way, that a pediatric dentist is going to be more apt to do airway problems than a primary care dentist, because Kevin, you and I both know most pediatric programs are not teaching this.
Yeah. Well, listen, one thing I would like to leave with everybody is that if a pediatric dentist, primary care family dentist, or an orthodontist knows how to widen the jaw of an 8-year-old, guess what? He knows how to widen the jaw of a 3-year-old, but managing the anxiety and the flack that he's going to get from his colleagues or she, that's a deterrent to them. But you know what? The mechanics are all the same. It ain't rocket science. And they've been doing it for 100 years. I can show you a stack of papers from medical and dental journals predating World War II that talked about physicians and orthodontists working together to help children gain respiratory advantage at the soonest possible age, before age 6. And it just all got lost in World War II. That's another problem we got to figure out, Susan. But meanwhile, we're going to try to do our best to inform the world what we can do.
We're working it. We are working it. We've made a lot of progress in the last couple of years with just pediatric awareness. I was even saying, you know, at the Collaboration Cures meeting, the American Academy of Oral and Systemic Health, when I first went there, which is only 10 years ago, and from there to now, my presidency, we didn't have anything about children at that meeting. So, you know, now we have a whole MyoTrack there. We have a whole, we're getting dentists and physicians together to collaborate and learn about early airway problems that, again, if we can shift this, we can totally change the devastating results of a rampant, I would say, almost a global rampant problem with obstructive sleep apnea.
Yeah, that's where it's going. And yep, we determined.
Yes.
Ending childhood apnea, ending childhood obesity, ending childhood cavities.
Oh, wouldn't that be amazing?
We just got to get the World Health Organization.
I love your optimism about early childhood caries disease, the disease of tooth decay go away. When we get further along in this podcast series, we'll hear from Doug Thompson and I about early childhood caries and caries disease in general, but we definitely will dive more into cavities and caries disease. You'll have access to the whole podcast, so you can always look on the Chew and Smile podcast with Doug Thompson to move right from here to caries disease if you're interested. But thank you, Kevin, so much for everything you do for our
profession. Tell Doug I said hi. Tell Doug Thompson I said hello. He's
I sure
guy.
Will. Yes.
Good. All right, you guys. And Laura, nice to meet you. I'm going to be tapping into your wisdom at some point. So
you got a book in there, Kevin.
You know what you're doing, obviously.
Yeah.
So, all right, you guys. Have a great day.
Thank you
great
so
talking
much.
To you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Brave Parent podcast with your host, Dr. Susan Maples, author of Brave Parent, and Lauren Eckert, founder of Burning Soul Press. Be sure to leave a podcast review and grab your copy of Brave Parent on Amazon or Audible or wherever you choose to buy your books. Bye for now.